Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. It was the kind of morning in Madison, Connecticut that made everything feel suspended. A gray, chilly, not quite spring day on a quiet street. Nestled behind some trees, 44 Middle Beach Road was the kind of house that might sell for a modest price in Middle America. But here, in a beach town perched on the Long Island Sound, the three-bedroom, two-bath ranch was worth about $750,000. The home had become a refuge for 48-year-old Barbara Beach Hamburg, a mother of two who had gone through a tumultuous divorce. But things were far from peaceful this morning. On March 3, 2010, around 10:30 a.m., police were called to the house after a horrifying discovery. In the side yard, partially obscured by some cushions, lay Barbara's body. She had been killed in a brutal attack, a combination of blunt force and sharp force injuries. Barbara's teenage daughter and older sister were the ones who found her. It was the first homicide Madison had seen in more than a decade. Of course, violence like this wasn't supposed to happen here. Madison was the kind of town that made people feel safe, all tidy charm and coastal privilege. The kind of place where neighbors smile, crime feels theoretical, and a mom getting murdered in broad daylight feels as unthinkable as a plane crash. But Barbara Hamburg's life hadn't followed the tidy arc suburban mythology promises. Once the smiling wife of a globe-trotting CEO, Barbara had spent the last several years locked in a bitter legal war with her ex-husband, Jeffrey Hamburg, a once-celebrated businessman who had fallen from grace after allegations of embezzlement. The day she was killed, she was scheduled to appear in family court to once again try to force Jeffrey to pay the child support and alimony that he owed her. She never made it. And yet, despite their history, despite the mountain of suspicion aimed squarely at him, Jeffrey Hamburg was never arrested. In fact, he had what seemed to be an ironclad alibi. He was already in court that morning, waiting for Barbara to arrive when she was murdered. Police have called the investigation active for years, but more than a decade later, there's been no arrest, no trial, and certainly no closure. And as Barbara's son Madison would come to learn, the story of his mother's death wasn't just about one troubled marriage or a courtroom no-show. It involved layers of secrets, including mysterious women-led pyramid scheme called a gifting table, a reported murder-for-hire plot, and a town police force that assumed they had it all figured out early on. Now, before things get a little confusing, let's address this cleanly. Yes, Madison is Barbara's son and also the name of the town where she was killed, just to keep that straight. Now, Madison was just 18 when his mother died, and he would spend much of his young adult life trying to unravel what really happened that day. He made a documentary about the murder. He filed public records requests. He even took the police to court, and eventually all the way to the state Supreme Court, to demand transparency in an investigation that had already gone cold. But the closer he got to the truth, the murkier things became. Who killed Barbara Hamburg? And why? Was it someone close to her? Someone with something to lose? Or was the truth buried deeper, under the surface of suburban respectability? Now, this case is more recent than most of the ones we cover on Crimes of the Centuries, but when I learned that best-selling author Megan Abbott had used Barbara's real-life murder as the inspiration for her latest novel, I was intrigued. And with Abbott's help, I wanted to take a closer look at the heartbreaking true story that came before the fiction, a story filled with secrets, suspicion, and a son's unrelenting search for justice. To understand how a woman like Barbara Hamburg could wind up murdered in broad daylight in her own front yard, and how that murder could go unsolved for more than a decade, you first have to understand her marriage. To do that, I watched Madison Hamburg's HBO documentary, Murder on Middle Beach, of course, and did my own reading of court documents, contemporary news coverage, and genealogy records, but I also interviewed Megan Abbott. You might know the author from her crime fiction novels and psychological thrillers, books like Beware the Woman and The Turnout. Her latest, El Dorado Drive, was inspired by the case we'll talk about in this episode. She's, of course, promoting the book, but she also hopes that by talking about the novel's inspiration, she can draw more attention to the case. Of Barbara and Jeff Hamburg, she said,
"They had been a very hotshot, high-rising couple when they married. He was on the move. He was this millionaire CEO of an electrical company."
The company was Southern Electric International, a subsidiary of Southern Company, one of the largest electric utility holding companies in the United States. SEI's focus was global, offering consulting and engineering services for international power projects, meaning that Jeffrey's job was the kind that sounds vague but important. He got paid well enough to travel a lot and talk to foreign governments about electricity. Barbara Beach had come from an upper-middle-class family that had its share of troubles. Her father, Richard Beach, who went by the nickname Sandy because, of course, had struggled with alcoholism and left the family. He was a low-tier celebrity in certain circles.
"Well, his name certainly is familiar here in Western New York and has been since he signed on the air at WKBW Radio way back in 1968 as Sandy Beach.
He was a beloved disc jockey in Buffalo, New York, and the kind of man people recognize by voice alone, which is probably why he didn't bother with the Alcoholic Anonymous tradition of keeping his last name private when he attended meetings.
"My name's Sandy Beach. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I came into AA in 1964, and I haven't been drunk since my first meeting, and I owe it all to not drinking. Yay!"
Barbara was the second youngest child in a brood of six. While her mother provided a warm upbringing, her father's departure and the hereditary disease of alcoholism naturally made things a bit unstable for her and her siblings. Several of the Beach children would become alcoholics themselves, but that would unfold later. As a young woman, Barbara had an electric personality. She was bright, friendly, and beautiful. When she and Jeffrey married in 1989, it looked to the rest of the family like she'd found a soulmate. They were a pair to envy. Abbott explains,
"She's sort of a blonde, all-American looking woman, the kind that you would see at the PTA meeting, sort of warm, sunny smile. And really, when she was married to Jeffrey, sort of wore the lovely wife of the rich man mantle beautifully."
After their two children, Madison and Barbara Alexander, nicknamed Allie, were born, Barbara seemed the quintessential suburban supermom, providing the steadiness at home that Jeffrey needed to be a jet-setting executive with a rising profile. The two built a life together in Connecticut, raising two children in a big, beautiful home. By all outward appearances, they were one of those couples who seemed to have it all. But if you've listened to this podcast before, you know how often that picture-perfect image cracks. The first outward signs came at Jeffrey's work.
"He had been let go under a cloud of scandal that had never really been resolved."
This part gets complicated, but from what I gather reading court documents, Jeffrey got fired after someone anonymously tipped off a reporter about an internal review into the company's ethical standards related to a project in Portugal. Essentially, Southern Company, the parent company, put out a press release saying they were looking into SEI's ethics And then, soon after, another one announcing Hamburg's dismissal due to the investigation, with a quote about upholding business standards. Hamburg, however, felt like he was being made a scapegoat, arguing that the company was trying to cover up something about their Portuguese business partner and publicly tarnished his name to do it. He won a defamation lawsuit to the tune of several million dollars. After the scandal,
then the marriage ended, and ever since, it had just been this sort of battle between the two of them.
Things got really ugly.
For instance, she had charged that her husband had been taking money from her children's trust and putting it into his own bank account.
What followed was years of litigation, accusations, and financial warfare. In Madison Hamburg's documentary, he presents documents showing that his father apparently stopped making child support and alimony payments despite court orders. It appeared he was hiding money, playing shell games with the children's trust fund, and using his business acumen not to support his family, but to outmaneuver them. Jeffrey, for his part, denied wrongdoing, but his business career wasn't exactly thriving in the aftermath. It's hard to recover after allegations of embezzlement. He launched another business afterward, one that involved regular trips overseas, especially to Dubai, but it's never been entirely clear what those companies actually did. And it wasn't just an anonymous tipster who raised red flags. In 2004, 6 years before her death, Barbara went to police alleging that Jeffrey was involved in an international money laundering scheme. She reportedly asked for immunity to protect herself while sharing what she knew. Whether that tip was taken seriously or where that investigation went remains murky. What is clear is that Barbara was struggling. After the divorce, she went from living in a grand house to renting a small ranch. An expensive small ranch, granted, but it was far more modest than she'd been used to, and she still had two young children. She was already predisposed to alcoholism, and after the split, her drinking became more problematic. So she went to rehab and came out a changed woman. But her children faced mental health and substance abuse struggles too, as Madison lays out in his documentary. He spells out his addiction issues, while Abbott says,
her daughter was sort of caught up in mental health issues that were probably related to how bad the divorce was.
Meanwhile, Barbara attempted to re-enter the workforce with no real financial safety net, and money was tight. The pressure was constant. But those who knew Barbara say she wasn't someone who gave up easily. She threw herself into recovery. She went to AA regularly. She reconnected with her large, boisterous family. She became part of a tight-knit group of women, mostly moms like her, trying to keep things together. And, as we'll learn later, also trying to make money in some unorthodox ways. The Barbara seen in old photos and home videos shown in her son's documentary comes across as magnetic. You get the sense that people wanted to be around her, that when she walked into a room, people noticed. She wasn't rich anymore, but she sure still had charisma. That may have been part of what made her so good at recruiting for a shadowy pyramid scheme known as a gifting table. We'll get to that soon. For now, what you need to know is this. By the winter of 2010, Barbara and Jeffrey were still locked in bitter legal disputes. She was still fighting to get the money she believed she and her children were owed. And on March 3rd, she and her ex-husband were both scheduled to appear in family court. Barbara never showed. Jeffrey did. That timing has cast a long, dark shadow over Jeffrey Hamburg ever since. And Madison has not shied away from asking, in front of cameras no less, whether his father had anything to do with his mother's death. In one of the more jaw-dropping moments of Murder on Middle Beach, Madison records a conversation with Jeffrey, asking him point blank if he killed Barbara. Jeffrey points to his alibi. He was in court that morning, waiting for her. Pressed on whether he had anything to do with her death at all, he refuses to answer directly, saying he won't talk about it. Not then, not now, but maybe someday? Maybe. Now, there's no physical evidence tying Jeffrey to the crime scene, no DNA match, no direct witnesses, but that hasn't stopped people from wondering. The police have said the case is still open, still active. But what does that even mean when a decade and a half goes by with no arrests and no apparent movement in the case beyond what the victim's son has done himself? In the vacuum of answers, speculation has flourished. So has silence. And perhaps no one has had to live with that silence more intimately than Madison Hamburg, a young man trying to find his mother's killer while grappling with the possibility that the answer might lie within his own family. But not all of the whispers have centered on Jeffrey, because around the time of Barbara's death, she had gotten involved in something unexpected, something that was supposed to offer community and support, but may have ended up turning friends into suspects. Let's talk about the gifting tables. By 2010, Barbara Hamburg was doing everything she could to stay afloat. She'd spent most of her adult life as a stay-at-home mom, raising her two kids in the kind of affluence most of us can only dream of. But post-divorce, the reality of her financial situation hit hard. With no alimony coming in, child support perpetually tied up in court, and the bills piling up, Barbara had to find a way to make money. And that's where things get weird. Her children didn't know this at the time, but Barbara had more going on in her life than AA meetings and family court. She was also part of a secretive financial circle with a distinctly suburban flavor, something called a gifting table. Now, if that sounds like something you'd see at a baby shower, it's not. Gifting tables were pyramid schemes, plain and simple. The women involved didn't see it that way, at least not at the time. They figured it was like Avon or multi-level marketing companies that sell makeup kits or candles, but without the products mucking things up. Now, for the record, I'm not a fan of MLMs because, in the end, they're usually just dressed-up pyramid schemes. But at least with MLMs, you can understand how people desperate to believe can kind of fool themselves into thinking, hey, I'm selling a product, so this is a legit business. Not so with gifting tables.
It's what makes it sort of feel more dubious and yet somehow less of a con, because you're not selling, you know, fake essential oils or cheap leggings or whatever these MLMs might be peddling. So I think it did give the aura of an investment club for women, except they're investing in one another.
The structure was deceptively simple. A woman would pay $5,000 to join the table. That bought her a seat at the bottom, referred to, rather cutely, as the appetizer level. Eight women would pay in at once, and as each moved up the tiers, salad, entree, and finally dessert, the woman at the top would receive a $40,000 payout. Then the tables would split into two, and the process would start again. Of course, there was a strategy behind that generosity. If those women made it to the top and collected their $40,000, Barbara would receive a return gift or be moved up faster in other tables. I mean, that's the thing about these schemes. Once they take off, the people who are good at them end up juggling multiple tables at once. You're a dessert here, an entree there. It's all about timing and networking and trust. But trust can be a fragile thing, especially when tens of thousands of dollars are exchanging hands. What makes this a straight-up pyramid scheme is the fact that the only way to move up was to bring new people in.
Like all pyramid schemes or Ponzi schemes, if you can't keep recruiting, you're never going to get to the top. And the longer it's in existence, the harder it is to ever ascend. It gets too large. People can't keep up. They can't stay.
But Barbara was really good at recruiting. She was outgoing, she was charismatic, she had an enormous social network already, plus a new one she was cultivating by way of the women she would meet at AA meetings. She wasn't pushy, but she had a way of making people feel welcome. And in a scheme like this, that's currency. By winter 2010, the area tables were growing out of control. Barbara had recruited women who didn't have a spare $5,000. People who didn't have that dough lying around were encouraged to find it in troubling ways. Pull out a second mortgage, borrow from family members, take a loan from their 401k. And remember, if recruitment slowed, the whole thing collapsed. You might never see your payout. You might lose your $5,000. And because there were no official documents or contracts, just word-of-mouth instructions and vague moral pep talks, there was nowhere to go if things went south. The gifting tables operated in a kind of secret economy among middle and upper middle class women, particularly in New England, at the height of the late 2000s recession. In towns like Madison, where many women had once lived comfortably on their husbands' incomes, the crash upended everything. These women weren't just trying to get rich. They were trying to survive, to keep their kids in school, their mortgages paid, their heads above water. For a while, the scheme thrived in Barbara's social circle. She'd been recruited by her aunt, Jill Platt, a name we'll come back to. In turn, Barbara brought in her sister, Conway Beach. The table had gotten so large, new branches had started forming. Multiple groups, dozens of women, all trying to ascend to that coveted dessert spot. And right before Barbara was murdered, she was supposedly next in line to receive a $40,000 payout. Now, let's be clear, there's no hard evidence tying the gifting tables to her death, but the timing is suspicious. Because when Barbara was killed, word had already been spreading that the feds were investigating the tables. Participants who'd been repeatedly assured by Jill and Barbara and another table leader, Donna Bello, that the tables were perfectly legal, were suddenly worried that they'd not only been conned, but that the police would come knocking. Eventually, Platt and Bello were prosecuted, not for murder, but for wire fraud, tax evasion, and related financial crimes. Federal investigators uncovered emails, participant lists, and what one prosecutor called a manual for how to hide the cash flow. Advice included not depositing large sums all at once, never writing things down, and treating all money transfers as gifts to avoid IRS scrutiny.
It's designed to avoid paying taxes or declaring income. They would offer advice about, you know, if you got $40,000, you don't want to deposit $40,000 in cash in your bank because they have to report that large deposit. And then this becomes a classic fraud situation.
I mean, it's almost worse, more sinister, that it was cloaked in sisterhood and the language of empowerment, because that was a huge part of the draw. Women who participated in the tables, including Barbara, often described them not just as financial lifelines, but as emotional ones, a place to find community, to feel seen, to regain some control after divorce or career derailment or financial collapse. These tables weren't just about money. They were about belonging, and that made it far easier to ignore the red flags. But once the money got big, once more and more strangers joined and the stakes rose, the tables became volatile. There was gossip, resentment, and maybe motive. Now, in Murder on Middle Beach, Madison doesn't say he believes the gifting tables were connected to his mother's murder, but he clearly finds the timing troubling. And he makes it clear that police did not investigate the tables thoroughly enough to rule anything out. In fact, we hear investigators admit they didn't consider the tables a potential source of suspects. Madison did. He interviewed women who were part of the scheme. He traced its growth. He tried to understand how much his mom was involved and how many people might have had something to lose if she talked or if she cashed out. But this case has no shortage of potential suspects. Take Barbara's sister, Conway Beach, who delivers one of the most jaw-dropping revelations of the entire series. That at one point, she tried to hire a hitman to kill Barbara and Jeffrey and Madison and Allie. She explained, on camera to Madison's face, that she had been spiraling at the time, furious with Barbara for fighting to take custody of Conway's son while Conway was using drugs. Here she is explaining to Madison that her plan was
to get all my money out of my 401k plan and get revenge against my baby sister, your mother, your father, and both of you, you and Allie.
How?
I wanted to hire a hitman. I was so messed up. I didn't know what to do. I was so angry. My whole family wasn't speaking to me.
Where did you go? How did you set it up?
I talked to complete strangers. I was drunk all of the time, so I really don't know who I talked to. I remember talking to a taxi cab driver, a bartender. How can I hire a hitman, you know? What do you gotta do to do that? But I knew that I was supposed to meet somebody at a hotel. And finally, I had some money. So I stayed in a hotel in Orlando. I don't know the name of it, but it was nice. And I remember going into the bar, waiting to meet my hitman, and drinking. And then I black out. And I woke up in my room, naked and without a penny. I had been rolled.
Conway said the plan was long behind her and that she and Barbara had made up well before the murder. She also claimed she told law enforcement about the attempted plot herself. But it's unclear if police ever fully vetted her alibi, which was that she was helping Jill Platt's mother organize a basement at the time of the killing. And what did happen that morning? Well, here's what we know. Barbara was supposed to be at court at 9:30 a.m., though she apparently didn't have the right time written down. She told several people, including Conway, that the hearing was at 2 p.m. The morning of March 3rd, Madison, already age 18, had been moved out for a while, but Allie was still in high school. She hadn't been doing well mentally or emotionally and didn't want to go to school that day, but Barbara drove her anyway. By Allie's telling, it wasn't a tense morning. The pair got coffee on the way to school, and then Barbara told the school Allie hadn't been feeling well and checked her in by 8 a.m. Then Barbara went back home. By 9-ish, Allie was already wanting to bail on the day, so she began calling and texting Barbara, who didn't answer. After a while of no response, she started texting and calling Conway, asking for Conway to bring her home instead. Conway did, and around 10:30 that morning, she picked Allie up from school and drove her to the home on Middle Beach. The pair said they immediately knew something was wrong when they pulled up to the house because a statue of a dog that always sat near the home's front porch was toppled over and broken. Barbara's purse was on the front lawn, as were her keys. Allie went toward one side of the house to check out the garage. Conway went the other direction. In the side yard, Conway spotted a sort of makeshift fort near some bushes. Here's Conway explaining at the scene.
I see right here, there are these cushions from her lawn furniture that are stacked up like blocks, building blocks. I go, and I kneel down, and I still hesitate, and I pull one cushion off, and I see, oh, it's an animal. Oh, thank God, it's just an animal. You know, like fur and blood. It's just an animal. And then God's like, you're not done yet, you're not done yet. You have to take all the cushions off.
She found Barbara's body.
It's just something I'll never forget. It was a horrible, horrible thing to see. You know what I mean? Horrible.
Now, you might think that Conway's murder-for-hire confession would be the most shocking thing about this case, and it's certainly up there. But what makes this even more surreal is that Conway told Madison she actually believed Allie might have been the killer. She said that Allie's mental health at the time was so concerning and her relationship with Barbara so volatile that she was convinced Allie hadn't really been driven to school by Barbara, that instead she had killed her mom, walked to school, then called Conway to come find the body together. Allie, mind you, was a child at the time. Whatever her mental state was, I'm not going to belabor this or contribute to a cloud of suspicion over her. By the documentary's end, we learn that there's school documentation showing that Barbara definitely dropped Allie off at the school. The notations say that Barbara herself told office workers Allie wasn't feeling well. So Barbara was definitely still alive at that point, meaning that she was killed sometime after dropping Allie off. For her part, Allie told her brother,
"Mom was so good to us. I think that in my crazy teenage years, I might have taken advantage of it. She believed in us. Even though we were filled with problems, she believed in us. I wish she was still here, but I definitely feel like she's still with me."
The fact that Allie's guilt was even in question for anyone so long points to how messy the personal entanglements in this case really were. By the time the police started investigating Barbara Hamburg's murder, they weren't just dealing with a contentious ex-husband or a paper trail of unpaid child support. They were looking at a secret financial ring involving dozens of women, large amounts of unreported cash, and layers of interpersonal conflict no one wanted to talk about publicly. And because it wasn't just a pyramid scheme, it was a pyramid scheme wrapped in secrecy, shame, and potential criminal exposure, cooperation was limited. People clammed up. Others vanished from the social scene. And what could have been a straightforward financial motive quickly morphed into a tangle of silence and suspicion. When a 48-year-old mother is found murdered in broad daylight in her own yard, most people expect police to act fast. Leads get chased, suspects questioned, forensics combed through, and in the early hours after Barbara Hamburg's body was discovered on March 3, 2010, it looked like that might happen. State police were called in almost immediately. Madison police detectives cordoned off the beachfront property. For a town that hadn't seen a homicide in more than a decade, it was a shock to the system.
Hi, everybody. We start with breaking news in Madison tonight, where a body has been found in a waterfront home there. Police tonight are treating it as a homicide.
News Channel 8, first on the scene at Middle...
One of the first people investigators sought out was Barbara's ex-husband, Jeffrey Hamburg. The two had been scheduled to appear in court that very morning, still locked in a bitter legal fight over money. In fact, that very court hearing could have led to Jeffrey's arrest. He owed Barbara some $150,000, and she was tired of playing nice about it. She had told her lawyer that she wanted to pursue putting Jeffrey in jail until he paid up. Of course, she never got that chance because she never reached the courthouse. Remember, she should have been there in the courtroom when she was murdered, but she somehow mixed up the hearing time. She told a friend the timing seemed odd. The hearings were always in the morning, but this one was scheduled for 2 p.m. That led Madison to speculate in his documentary that someone might have called her and fed her the wrong time in the days before the hearing, maybe to ensure she was home alone, an easier target. Naturally, all this piqued investigators' interest, so they sought an interview. But Jeffrey wasn't cooperative. He hired a defense attorney right away and said nothing. In some ways, that set the tone for everything that followed. According to the New Haven Register, police declined to say whether the case appeared domestic in nature. They wouldn't confirm if they had any suspects, wouldn't say if Barbara had known her killer. From the start, the message to the public was, "We're working on it, and that's all we're saying." Now, that kind of restraint is expected in the earliest stages of a murder investigation, but days turned into weeks, then months. And for Barbara's son, Madison Hamburg, those weeks became years. years with no arrests, no public updates, no closure. What he did get was resistance. In the years following his mother's murder, Madison began filing Freedom of Information requests with the Madison Police Department, seeking access to their investigation files. What he got in return was a stone wall. The department claimed the case was still quote-unquote active, and therefore they couldn't release anything, not even redacted reports, without risking a future prosecution. Now, that sounds reasonable at first, but here's the problem. It became a kind of permanent excuse, because Connecticut, like all U.S. states, has no statute of limitations for murder. So technically, any unsolved murder case can be labeled active forever, even if no real investigative work is happening behind the scenes. In Murder on Middle Beach, we see Madison trying to navigate this wall of silence firsthand. Smartly, he recorded most meetings and phone calls along the way, which are used in the documentary to poke holes in some contradictory statements the police made over the years. He tried to convince local officials, politely but persistently, that what he was asking for wasn't unreasonable, that families of victims deserve transparency, that the public does too. Eventually, his fight gained traction. Madison's collaborator on the documentary, filmmaker Anika Niemeyer, became the named client in a case brought by the Media Freedom and Information Access Clinic at Yale Law School. The legal team argued that the police were misusing an exemption in Connecticut's Freedom of Information Act, one that lets law enforcement withhold records if releasing them would interfere with, quote, prospective law enforcement action, end quote. The state's attorneys argued that the exception should apply because the case was still technically open. There was still a suspect, they claimed, and arrest could theoretically happen. But that was as far as they'd go. The MFIA clinic pushed back. They said a mere possibility of future prosecution wasn't enough, especially when no charges had been filed in, at that point, over a decade. It's now been 15 years. If there's no forward movement, they argued, then you can't keep using that as a blanket excuse to deny public access. And the Connecticut Supreme Court agreed. The court ruled that police departments must meet a higher bar to invoke that FOIA exemption. Going forward, they must show that a reasonable possibility of future legal action exists, meaning not just that it's technically allowed, but that there's some realistic indication it's being pursued. Meaning that it's not just technically possible, but that there's some realistic indication it's being pursued. It was a big win, not just for Madison and Annika, but for cold case transparency across the state. It's the reason I consider calling this case a crime of the century is appropriate, even if there's a lot we still don't know. But even with that ruling, the fight isn't over yet. The Supreme Court sent the case back down to the FOI Commission to decide whether the Barbara Hamburg files, specifically, must now be released. As of this recording, that decision is still pending. Madison is still waiting. Now, here's where things get even more frustrating. Police have claimed in interviews that they know who did it. Megan Abbott mentioned this in our conversation, that at various points, law enforcement has made vague statements to that effect. But if that's true, why hasn't anything happened?
It is one of those enigma wrapped in a puzzle inside that you feel like you're never going to quite get to the bottom of it.
This case exists in a kind of purgatory, not cold enough to allow access, not hot enough to lead to an arrest. There are also inconsistencies in how police handled evidence. DNA collected at the scene did not match Barbara's ex-husband, Jeffrey Hamburg, the person many assumed would be suspect number one. But police told Madison that DNA under Barbara's fingernails could be traced to a male of Hamburg lineage. At one point, Madison realized that he himself was a suspect.
What the fuck? What if that's why they're stonewalling me? It changes, like, all of the information we heard, the Hamburg lineage, could be pertaining to me. phone off 24 hours could be pertaining to me. Do they think I'm doing this in a way to, like, know what they know as a suspect? If I'm their main suspect, they're missing a lot.
Now, I'm not actually convinced he ever was truly a suspect. I think they probably hoped that by implying that he was, he would back off his document demands. To his credit, he didn't. He kept working to piece together a puzzle with most of the pieces blacked out. And it's not just frustrating, it's destabilizing. Because if the person who killed Barbara Hamburg is still out there and hasn't even been named publicly, what does that say about accountability, about justice, about who gets answers and who doesn't? At one point in the documentary, Madison makes an observation that feels quietly devastating. He says that just after his mom's death, he assumed justice would just happen, that someone, somewhere, some adult would step in and fix things. But they didn't. And he realized no one was going to come save them. If he wanted answers, he'd have to find them himself. So that's what he did. He picked up the camera and began asking the uncomfortable questions. He got stonewalled. He got misled. He was told to stop digging. And still, he kept going. His father, Jeffrey, was one of the main people urging him to drop the investigation. Any question about Barbara, even simple inquiries a child might have about a lost parent, like her personality, was met with Jeffrey's curt, "I'm not going to talk about it." Occasionally, he'd seem to lower his guard, only to insult Barbara, labeling her a manipulative drunk, and even hinting that Aunt Jill, one of the gifting table convicts, might know more. Yet when Madison pressed with even the most straightforward questions, his father remained frustratingly evasive. Madison even resorted to secretly recording him, hoping to penetrate that wall. But the most he ever got was a firm refusal to talk. While this could be interpreted as self-preservation or legal strategy, it undeniably has fueled suspicion. But Barbara's case exposes more than just family dynamics. It lays bare a profound failure of justice. The system, it seems, settled for ambiguity, leaving a family to navigate an abyss of grief and unanswered questions completely on their own. Barbara's murder didn't just shatter a family. It revealed the deep fault lines already present beneath the surface and underscored just how ill-equipped our justice system can be when faced with a crime that unravels not only a life, but an entire network of relationships. The cases that truly haunt us aren't always those with sensational twists or explosive trials. Sometimes they're the ones where every crack, every systemic failure is agonizingly clear, even when the killer remains unknown. To research this case, I reviewed dozens of news articles, court filings, and academic sources related to Barbara Hamburg's murder, the Connecticut FOIA ruling, and the gifting tables pyramid scheme. Key sources included reporting from the New Haven Register, People Magazine, and Yale Law School's Media Freedom and Information Access Clinic, along with relevant state Supreme Court opinions and legal filings. A central source was Murder on Middle Beach, the riveting HBO documentary by Barbara's son, Madison Hamburg, which features extensive recorded conversations, interviews, and family footage. Special thanks to author Megan Abbott for her time and insight. I'll mention, too, that she's one of my partner Scott's favorite authors. Abbott's novel, El Dorado Drive, inspired in part by this case, is available wherever books are sold. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.